The earthquakes in Turkey have upended the lives of so many people. They might do the same politically for Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
I think there is a pretty good chance that the opposition parties will defeat Erdogan at the ballot box.
Also today, Cambodia is shutting down the last independent news source in the country. Journalists at that outlet are beside themselves.
I don't know what to do next. To me, I think it is like pushing me to the corner, and I think maybe it is time for me to retire.
Tough news for people who've tried to uphold press freedom. And how do birds do Valentine's Day? For one species in Costa Rica, courtship is about singing and dancing.
They will do it hour after hour during the day. They'll do it day after day, and they'll do it for about 9 months of the year.
Remember, he's talking about singing and dancing there. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. Last week's earthquakes were devastating for countless numbers of people in Turkey and Syria, the dead and the injured, and those now without homes. That is the human impact. The quakes could also end up having a huge effect on Turkey's domestic politics. Many people in Turkey say the government's post-disaster response has been slow and ineffective, which likely will mean a tough road ahead for President Recep Tayyip Erdogan as he eyes a national vote and his possible re-election later this spring. For more on this, we're joined by Gulnul Tol. She helps run the Turkey program at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Gulnul, I understand that some of your own relatives died in these earthquakes. So first of all, I just want to wish you and your family our condolences.
Thank you.
Before we talk about the political consequences for President Erdogan, I would like to hear your own family story. Can you tell us what happened last week?
Well, Antakya is one of the worst hit cities in the country. And after the earthquake hit, the city was leveled to the ground. And my family members were trapped under the rubble. We waited for 48 hours until the government's rescue agency showed up, only to tell us that they could not help us because they had received instructions to focus their rescue operations elsewhere. And as a result, my family members died, as did thousands of others.
So sadly, you have a clear window into what's been going on, Gulnul, and for you, it's not a pleasant picture. How does the public generally in Turkey view the government's disaster response so far?
There is a lot of anger and frustration directed at President Erdogan and his government's slow response. In previous earthquakes, the worst one that we experienced was in 1999, and at the time, the government was also targeted and criticized for its slow response. But at the time, the military had been dispatched to the earthquake zone, and there were civil society organizations helping victims on the ground, and there were state agencies again showed up shortly after the earthquake hit. This time around, that was not the case. People waited and waited and waited, and there was no help. So I saw the anger and the frustration firsthand. And remember, this is a region that have largely voted for President Erdogan's party. 10 provinces have been hit, and out of those 10 provinces, 7 of them are run by the ruling party. So this is a significant constituency for President Erdogan. And people were angry that he was not there. People were angry that state rescue agencies were not there. There was simply no one to help them.
Is this a story really about just unprecedented earthquakes, or did something change this year in kind of like the overall kind of political makeup of the country?
What Erdogan wants us to believe, immediately right after the earthquake hit, his team prepared a video. And the main narrative of that video was that this was an unprecedented disaster and no other government in the world could have responded to this effectively. But I think there were so many things that this government could have done and did not do. Since the last big earthquake in 1999, basically scientists and bureaucrats, they've been pushing government to do more, to be prepared to disasters like this. And he did not take any of those steps.
Is anyone in Turkey, aside from hardcore Erdogan loyalists, is anyone saying they empathize with the government on this point?
Not really. There is, again, so much anger, so much frustration. And the opposition parties from early on, they changed their previous narrative. So when disasters struck the country in the past, opposition parties they mostly lined up behind the government, saying that this is not the right time to talk about politics. This was not the right time to point fingers. But this time they changed their narrative, saying that this was all on Erdogan, and it was his corruption and misrule that paved the way for this disaster. So in many ways, the opposition parties mobilized the popular anger and frustration. And now I think a large majority of the country is putting the blame on the Erdogan government.
So, Gulnu, what do you think all this means for Erdogan in the May election? Is there an opposition figure who could actually exploit this post-earthquake vulnerability?
The elections are scheduled to take place in May, but under these circumstances, I don't think they will be held in May. So they will probably be postponed. According to the Constitution, Erdogan has to hold the elections in June. But yesterday, a close associate of Erdogan suggested that we postpone the elections for a year. I think Erdogan understands that this is a difficult time for him, and he does not want to face the elections now. But obviously, it's unconstitutional. Having said that, this did not stop Erdogan before. He's done many things that are against the constitution. So now the question is whether the opposition can rally its base and say, no, we are going to hold the elections on time in June. And if that happens, I think there is a pretty good chance that the opposition parties will defeat Erdogan at the ballot box.
How much do you worry, Gulnul, that these earthquakes could represent a way for Erdogan to indefinitely stay in power in the name of waiting for a stable time to hold elections?
I worry about it a lot. And in fact, again, if he manages to postpone the elections for a year, I think he can turn this around. He will use international aid to rebuild these cities, and he will take necessary measures to embark on another building spree, and that will help him stay in power, and he can indefinitely postpone the election. So that's why it's critical for the opposition parties right now to push the government to hold the election soon and not wait for a year.
Gulnu Tol is with the Middle East Institute. She's also the author of Erdogan's War, A Strongman's Struggle at Home and in Syria. Gulnu, thanks very much for your thoughts on this. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Gulnu got the cross in a ball.
The 2022 FIFA World Cup in Qatar drew fans from all over the globe. There were not enough hotel rooms near the stadiums, so Qatar brought in portable houses. A Qatari official gave Chinese TV a tour of these living spaces made out of steel shipping containers.
And you can see it, how is it in a good condition and a high quality. The good thing with the cabin, you have your full privacy.
These mobile houses rented out for $200 a night during the World Cup. Now they're getting a second noble life as emergency housing in Turkey and Syria. Qatar has some company when it comes to providing emergency shelters. Swedish furniture giant IKEA has partnered with an NGO, and they are sending house building kits ready to assemble to the earthquake zone.
So we are right now deploying 5,000 units, which are now on the trucks on their way towards Turkey.
That's Johan Carlson, CEO of Better Shelter. It's providing inexpensive but sturdy shelters in 80 different countries. Each one is about 180 square feet. The walls, the roof, door, window screen, and furnishings fit into two cardboard boxes for shipping. It takes about 4 hours to assemble one, IKEA style.
The first time you do it, you do some cursing and you need to get all the bits together. When you do it the second time, you know how to do it. The third time around, it goes very quickly.
Humanitarian agencies on the ground will decide where the donated shelters are to be located over the coming weeks. The need, though, is right now, as this Turkish woman explains. Habibe Polat told the New York Times, "Our conditions are really bad. We are freezing. There is no electricity. We are sleeping in the yard of a mosque. We can't find shelter." Altogether, Qatar and the IKEA Foundation are providing houses for about 15,000 families. But with hundreds of thousands of people suddenly homeless, the need for housing remains an enormous challenge. One of Spain's most wanted fugitives could soon face extradition from Belgium. He's not wanted for murder or theft, but for trying to steer Spain's northeast region of Catalonia toward independence. Carles Puigdemont is a former president of Catalonia. He fled to Brussels after leading an illegal effort to secede from Spain in 2017. A recent decision by the European Union's highest court now has everyone wondering whether he could be sent home. Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
First, a bit of backstory. In 2017, after months of street protests where hundreds of thousands turned out demanding independence, Catalonia's government organized a vote on seceding from Spain. Spain's highest court ruled it unconstitutional, but then-President Carles Puigdemont held the vote anyway. The police moved in, wielding truncheons against voters. Most of Catalonia's leaders were soon jailed for sedition, but not Puigdemont.
I davant dels nostres conciutadans, el mandat del poble que Catalunya esdevingui un estat independent en forma de república.
The Catalan president declared the region independent, then fled to the European Union's capital, Brussels. Since then, he's fought to keep the cause alive and to stay put. Spain's been pressing Brussels to extradite him. The case eventually reached the EU's highest tribunal. Its conclusion this January has both sides claiming victory. On the one hand, EU member states must honor extradition requests, but there are some exceptions. For example, if a defendant can prove they won't be fairly treated at home, or if they're part of a specific persecuted group. That's what Puigdemont is claiming now. He spoke to reporters after hearing the judgment.
Avui, la sentència del Tribunal de Justícia de la Unió Europea deixa les extradicions...
The court's ruling leaves Spain's extradition order dead on arrival. We Catalans who want independence are just the sort of persecuted group cited by the tribunal.
Spanish prosecutors dismiss that take. They're preparing a new extradition request. In the meantime, Catalans themselves appear just as divided. Just bringing up the subject sets elderly couple Maria Fernandez Baca and her husband Albert Casa squabbling. They're sitting in the sun on a park bench in Barcelona.
Puigdemont should be brought home to face justice. He's a traitor to his own people.
I hold the opposite view of my wife. I'm pro-independence, okay? I mean, I wish the best for the Spanish, but I want to be free. And Spain won't let me.
Clearly, the topic can still get people's blood boiling. But since the ill-fated referendum, polls suggest support for Catalan independence has waned.
Después de eso, ha venido la pandemia, como decía, la crisis.
Iñaki Pardo has been covering the story for the Spanish newspaper La Vanguardia. He says the police crackdown was followed by the COVID-19 pandemic and the global economic crisis. It all pushed independence down the priority list, he says. There's still a small core group that goes to protests, but he says we used to see 500,000 people. It's anyone's guess, Pardo says, as to what comes next. But if Puigdemont were extradited, he says, it would surely reignite political tensions. Most of Puigdemont's supporters hope that day never comes.
Bimba, come here.
On a hiking path above Barcelona, Catalan Joan Badia walks his dog, a Breton spaniel named Bimba. Badia holds out hope for independence one day. He says Puigdemont stumping from the heart of Europe helps the cause.
I hope Puigdemont doesn't come back because he has no guarantee of fair treatment in Spain. The strategy of staying away is right because it's forced the rest of Europe to pay attention and get involved. Thanks to him, Spain's repression of Catalonia is now known.
Repression, Badia says, referring to what he says are the high taxes Madrid collects with little return investment in the region. It's also a nod to some spying scandals in which the central government has allegedly illegally intercepted communications of Catalan leaders. That so-called repression is also part of what journalist Iñaki Pardo considers part of the endless debate.
Siguen atrapados en esa retórica. Nadie dice... Esperemos que no, ¿no?
Both sides are trapped in their rhetoric, he says. Madrid demanding extradition, Puigdemont independence. Let's hope we're not stuck in time, he says, like Bill Murray in Groundhog Day. But who knows, he says, it's complicated. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Cambodia is pulling the plug on the last remaining independent news organization in the country. Prime Minister Hun Sen accused the Voice of Democracy of hurting his government's reputation. Ashley Westerman has our story.
This was the scene at the office of the Voice of Democracy on Sunday, the news outlet's last day of operation. In this video posted to Twitter, staffers are shuffling about the Phnom Penh office, looking a bit defeated. One woman is crying uncontrollably. Journalist Mech Dara was there. He covered crime and corruption for VOD for about 3 years.
As soon as I stepped into the inside door, I heard the sound of the people crying. out loud, yes. So it's very emotional at the time.
VOD's closure comes just days after they ran a story claiming Prime Minister Hun Sen's son, Hun Munet, had signed an aid agreement to donate $100,000 to Turkey for earthquake assistance, overstepping his father's authority. In response, the prime minister gave VOD 72 hours to apologize and retract the article or face legal action. The deadline was soon narrowed to 24 hours. Mech Dara says he didn't sleep those 2 days.
I went to buy the sleeping pill. And when I take the sleeping pill, I could not feel sleeping. I struggling like, what way I do?
When VOD instead pointed out that their article cited a government spokesperson, their media license was revoked, and the access to both their English and Khmer websites blocked on Sunday, as promised.
For me, I know that it's going to come, but I don't think it will come as quick like this.
VOD's reporting have always been seen and viewed as more critical of the government, but also of other issues in relations to land grabbing and human rights issues.
That's Varak U, the president of Future Forum, a policy research think tank in Phnom Penh. He says VOD's work has always been in the crosshairs of the government. The outlet was started by the Cambodian Center for Human Rights, founded by Khem Sokha, a longtime opposition figure of the Hun Sen government.
It's not a complete shock, but I'm a bit surprised that they're actually doing that in such an abrupt way and on such a very, very minor issue. But all in all, I think it's part of a more systematic restriction.
Human rights and free speech watchers have condemned the move, many drawing parallels with the 2017 forced closing of the independent English language news outlet, the Cambodia Daily, which also took place ahead of general elections. Many diplomats have also rebuked the shutdown, with the U.S. Embassy in Phnom Penh calling it disturbing and urging the government to revisit the decision. Mech Dara says for now, the former Voice of Democracy staff will take a break, assess their situation, and then decide how to move forward, if at all.
I don't know what to do next. To me, I think it is like pushing me to the corner, I think. And I think maybe it is time for me to retire.
These kinds of restrictions have been an integral part of Hun Sen's nearly 40-year rule. And thanks to effectively eliminating any political competition in this year's elections, analysts say the former Khmer Rouge soldier is likely to win yet again, meaning the future of the press, free speech, and dissent in Cambodia looks bleak. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Taipei, Taiwan.
It's February 14th, and that means it's red roses, boxes of chocolates, and all sorts of grand romantic gestures. That's just here in the human world. We were curious about how matters of the heart play out in the animal world. Anna Kusmer, the world's romance correspondent for today, has that story.
Cole Porter was onto something when he wrote this famous lyric, sung here by Ella Fitzgerald. Birds do it, bees do it.
Even educated fleas do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
It's hard to know if animals actually fall in love, but many of them are monogamous, says Nora Pryor. She studies animal relationships at Cornell University's psychology department.
A lot of us think of mammals and primates when we think of, you know, monogamy and sort of pair bonding. But actually, there's monogamous insects and reptiles and fish.
But she says there's a reason why lovebirds is a common phrase. Only 4% of mammals form monogamous bonds, where a mating couple sticks together. For birds, that number is closer to 90%.
They're kind of like the hallmark taxa for being monogamous.
It seems that each species of bird has its own weird, wonderful style of romance. I swear, watching nature documentaries is more titillating than any season of The Bachelor.
The male 12-wired bird of paradise is the only bird in the world that has tail ornaments like this, used to tickle the face of a prospective mate.
To find some good examples of top-notch bird flirting, I spoke to avian expert Tim Wright from New Mexico State University. He told me about one of his favorites. It's a hummingbird from Costa Rica called the long-billed hermit. Males will cluster together in small areas to put on their mating displays.
People have sometimes likened this to human discos, for example.
The birds will chirp like this, and then when a female comes around, that's when the dancing starts. Well, you can't take-
remarkable thing about it is that they don't just do this singing and dancing once. They will do it hour after hour during the day. They'll do it day after day, and they'll do it for about 9 months of the year.
They dance so hard for so long. Many of them die of starvation and fatigue.
So these guys are really living hard and dying young.
But Wright says if dancing's not your thing, there's another place to look for inspiration. Yellow-naped Amazons, a type of parrot also in Costa Rica. These birds mate for years at a time and raise their young together.
I've seen some pairs be together for 4 or 5 years, and it may be far longer than that.
What keeps the spark alive for these parrots? Sharing a hobby, specifically singing.
They'll do these duets that are very creative in terms of they use the same types of notes, but they'll combine them with slight variations in different ways each time they do it.
But it isn't all rosy goodness in the avian world of love, and it's important to be honest about all types of bird behaviors. So I talked to Jordan Borsma, who's a postdoc at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. He studies fairy wrens in Australia and New Guinea.
So like a lot of birds, you know, they mate mostly for life.
But while she's tending to the eggs, the male will stray. He'll find flower petals that match his brightly colored feathers.
And then they'll carry that to neighboring females and display this object with their plumage to try to curry some attraction.
If that works, he becomes monogamish. Borsma says it's not just fairy wrens. Many birds mate outside their long-term pairings and are still considered monogamous by scientists.
At least in the bird world, monogamy does not equate to loyalty. So there can be a lot of promiscuity even in these systems where the species is monogamous.
But he says those crazy kids, they make it work.
Both sexes often do it. And so they might, you know, have an understanding between each other. And at the end of the day, they come back together and still raise their young together. So, you know, it seems to work.
So maybe the lesson from the animal world this Valentine's Day is you have to find a relationship style that works for you. But also, don't date a fairy wren, even if he brings you petals. He's not worth your time, girl. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
We'll be right back. You're with The World. Iran is looking to the east. President Ibrahim Raisi is the first Iranian leader to make an official visit to China in 20 years. But it's really Beijing that has the most leverage in this relationship.
The invitation to Raisi, of course, is like Raisi going into, you know, the golden trap.
Charting the course of China-Iran relations and where they're headed, coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More than a week after two powerful earthquakes, rescue crews are still clearing debris all across southeastern Turkey. One man was found today alive after spending nearly 200 hours under the rubble. But at least 37,000 people are now known to have died so far in the disaster. The United Nations estimates that the death toll could even double. Many families have spent the past week sleeping in their cars outside of the rubble of the former homes of their missing relatives, holding on to hope. The World's Jury Biscarin reports from the Turkish town of Islahiyah.
These were the Huzur apartments, named after the Turkish word for peace. Now, rescue crews are slowly picking through what's left.
Anne, mother, teyze, dayı.
Sibel Çalışkan and her family sit by the side of the road around a campfire. She says eight of her relatives were staying in an apartment on the fourth floor. Her mother, her aunt Elif, her niece Leyla, and her nephew Yiğcan. Sibel packed her husband and her daughter in the car and drove down from Istanbul as soon as they heard the news. Everyone is dead, she says. There's no one left here. It's over. But still, she waits. It took 30 hours for help to arrive in Islahiyeh. The rubble is a mass of rebar and crumbled concrete, a child's bicycle. On the sidewalk are memories kept by their relatives who survive.
Anneannem her gün arar beni. Ne yaptın?
Şeval, Sibel's 26-year-old daughter, says her grandmother would call her every day. What did you do today? How was work? Have you gotten home yet? Did you eat? don't forget to rest. In August, the family came in from all over the country to gather at her grandmother's apartment to celebrate her cousin's wedding. Cheval pulls out her phone to show me pictures of them, smiling faces around a table. Her mother, Sibel, says her nephew and his new wife were expecting a baby in the coming months. The whole family couldn't wait. How can 8 people die in a family? We lost them all at once. We're in shock, Sibel says. The air is punctuated by ambulance sirens, dust, and the smell of death. But Islahie was once a comfortable town of 32,000 people, nestled in a valley where people grew grapes and tended olive trees, encircled by snowy mountains and pine forests. It grew out of a small village where everyone used to live in small 1 or 2 story structures. Sibel grew up here, but moved to Istanbul as an adult. There's no one left. My entire hometown has disappeared, Sibel says. And I can't even call my mom to talk about it. The Peace apartments were 7 stories tall and newly built, just like so many apartment blocks in Islahie. They stood just 25 miles from the epicenter of the first earthquake that rocked southern Turkey and northern Syria last Monday, measuring a 7.8 in magnitude. Our government would build buildings and think that this place is developed. This is how they see development, Cheval says. They think a developed country is developed with tall buildings. Now, none of these buildings are safe to enter. There's no electricity anywhere and limited gasoline. So families like the Çalışkan's sleep in their car against the low din of machinery. They plan to stay until the remains of all of their family members have been identified, and the last hope that someone is alive is truly gone. There's no toilet or bathroom. People get clothing from aid workers. People here have nothing on their feet, the same way they escaped their homes, Sibel says, and they live on the streets like this. During the day, kids play near aid tents set up by the Turkish Red Crescent as their mother sits with a 1,000-yard stare. Like so many family gatherings, Sibel and Cheval's relatives have come in from all corners of the country to sit and wait. They gather under blankets around a fire on the sidewalk. They make tea in a camp kettle. Cheval shares a package of cookies. Cheval studied psychology in school. When she meets other families sitting out here in the cold, she tries to comfort them. A 5-year-old child was rescued from this rubble pit, she says. But what can she possibly do for her? What kind of life can I offer that child, Cheval says. We can give her food so she won't be hungry. But I can't give her her mother. I can't give her her father. I can't make her forget what she went through. The families talk about their grief, young futures cut short, those lost years of the pandemic when they couldn't visit their elderly parents. And sometimes the pain gives way to anger and blame. This is not an act of God. This is completely the work of people, Sibel says. They shouldn't build such buildings. It's an earthquake zone. This place was such a beautiful place. Why did they spoil its natural state? Sibel says she places the blame in the builders and contractors who evaded safety regulations to build structures like the Peace apartments. They are all murderers. That's what I call them, murderers, she says. They could have taken care of this. We were wiped off the map, she says. For the world, I'm Dari Buscarin, in Islahiye, Turkey.
Today, the president of Iran, Ibrahim Raisi, made a big visit to China. No Iranian leader has visited in 20 years. The two parties both say they discuss nuclear policy, but what else is there to what seems to be a diplomatic curve, if anything? Anoush Etteshami joins us to understand this better. He's a professor of international relations at Durham University in the UK and knows a lot about Iran's diplomacy. Based on what's come out of this meeting, what do you see as the main headlines here?
I think actually there is a lot riding on this for both parties. If I may, I'll just quickly look at the Chinese position. For China, Iran is a valued asset because of its ideological standing with regard to the West and the US in particular. But also, President Xi Jinping's visit to Saudi Arabia last month left quite a bitter taste in the mouth of the Iranians, in that he saw not just all the heads of the Gulf Cooperation Council countries around the Saudis, but also many Arab leaders who traveled to Riyadh. And in that summit, three statements that came out were quite problematic from Iran's perspective. One was about the need to make sure that there is respect for every country in terms of law and order and security. The second was that Iran must ensure that its nuclear program remains peaceful. And the third was that there must be negotiations and dialogue over the three islands in the Persian Gulf. For Iran, all these three are red lines. And so, of course, you know, the vice premier was hurriedly sent to Tehran following Iran's protestations. And then an invitation was issued to President Raisi to go to Beijing. And here we are. So for Chinese to kind of smooth all these wrinkles is important, because Iran, in many ways, is the last El Dorado in this part of Asia. Market of 85 million people, highly educated, vast natural resources. Oil, gas are just tip of the iceberg. And of course, geopolitically, very well placed for access to Europe, to the Mediterranean, to the Indian Ocean, but also the vast expanses of the Caucasus and Central Asia. For the Iranians, on the other hand, the relationship is even more significant because Iran doesn't have many friends exactly, regionally and internationally. Raisi is welcome in Moscow. That's about it, really. And it seems to have thrown its lot with the Russian aggression against Ukraine, which I suspect will come back to bite it down the line. China is Iran's largest trading partner. It's the biggest importer of Iran's oil. It has promised through this 25-year agreement signed in 2021 to pour in many billions of dollars into Iran's economy, whether for energy, whether for infrastructure, whether for building and construction and petrochemicals and such like. Raisi has gone there partly to make sure that the Chinese live up to expectations.
Is Beijing in a position to choose sides in this kind of perennial Iran-Saudi Arabia face-off?
Well, actually, I don't think the Chinese want to be in that position. The Chinese want to be able to ride the storm, to stay clear of petty squabbles. I mean, you know, their trade with the GCC, with Saudi Arabia,
Gulf Cooperation Council,
is very lucrative. Yeah, the Saudis are completely committed to expansion of ties with China. The UAE's trade with China is more than three times what Iran's is with China. And you put that in context of the UAE's Emirates population of about 10 million people, then you'll see exactly how important those markets are to the Chinese. And Xi Jinping's visit to Riyadh was precisely to underline these links. But also, the Chinese can't afford to have it at the expense of Iran, because Iran really is the remaining jewel in the crown.
Obviously, we have to see the economic potential of a China-Iran relationship that this visit today by Raisi to Beijing represents in part. But what do you make of these statements issued by both sides on nuclear policy? China said they are with Iran in solidarity, but also seem to offer help with some kind of nuclear peace deal like the one Iran has been negotiating with the U.S. and Europe. What's going on there?
I think the Chinese are telling the world, not the Iranians, that, look, we've got to fix this JCPOA,
the nuclear deal.
You know, he tore it up in 2018, quite visibly and physically, as you remember. That has led to a major crisis in terms of Iran's nuclear program, because Iran is now enriching uranium unhindered to levels well beyond what was agreed in the JCPOA, the Joint Cooperation Agreement over the nuclear program. And Iran is now enriching 65-70% of uranium, which is dangerous because that's now reaching weapons grade. For China, proliferation is a really bad thing. In this part of the world, is not good news for them because, A, it threatens Israel, another of China's close security economic partners, and also it will encourage Saudi Arabia to proliferate as well. And that's absolutely no good to them, one. Secondly, it's very clear that so long as Trump-type sanctions remain on Iran, China cannot unleash the potential in trade and investment in Iran.
Well, that's a kind of optimistic way of looking at it. I think of what China said, that they are with Iran in solidarity. What do you think that means? Is it just supportive words, or could that actually maybe mean they'll help with Iran's weapons program?
No. Those are just forms of words that Iranians would like to hear as they kind of roll up their sleeves to try and re-enter a negotiating theater. So you can see that the Chinese have got all the cards this time round. And the invitation to Raisi, of course, is like Raisi going into, you know, the golden trap.
Anoush Etteshami is a professor of international relations at Durham University in the UK, where he focuses on Iran's diplomacy. Anoush, thanks very much for being with us today.
My entire pleasure. All the best to you.
If you're scrambling, looking for a last-minute dinner reservation tonight for two, good luck. Remember, though, not everyone has a chance to be with their significant other on Valentine's Day. Backlogs for visa interviews at U.S. embassies across the world are keeping thousands of newlyweds from starting a new life together here in the U.S. The Houston Chronicle's Elizabeth Troval got in touch with one couple from Pakistan. They've gotten creative with ways of keeping their love alive after years of visa delays.
It's still dark at 6:30 a.m. in College Station, Texas. Hamid Ulhaq chuckles while video chatting with his wife, Harim Salman, as he lays with his laptop. His wife is just getting off work at her university job in Karachi, Pakistan, 8,000 miles away.
It's hardly like a proper, you know, like a married life because you're always so far apart. And especially with COVID, I think we couldn't meet for almost 2 years.
Salman video chats from her mom's apartment, lit up with late afternoon sun. Most of their 3.5 years of marriage have been like this, virtual. But they've found ways to make it work.
We do this Netflix watch party together, to watch movies together.
They have Friday tea time. They play online games, Scrabble, Ludo.
Ludo, it's like a super Pakistani-Indian game. Everybody here knows it.
Hawk was living in the U.S. when they met. Salman's cousin introduced them online. Once they got married, they thought a life together was imminent. But long delays in visa processing have put a real strain on their first years of marriage. Salman has even had to say no to jobs because she wasn't sure of the timeline of her visa.
You're living this constant state of, like, you know, uncertainty. And Hamid and I, like, since we've been married, we've, I don't know, lived together in person with each other for, what, less than 6 months?
That's why the couple is suing the State Department.
It should not take 3 to 5 years for a U.S. citizen to petition their spouse to come to the USA. And it doesn't for most nationalities.
Immigration attorney Curtis Morrison is representing Hawk, who is a U.S. citizen, and 9 others whose Pakistani spouses have faced long delays getting the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad to schedule consular interviews. Interviews that are one crucial step in the immigrant visa process.
The State Department is throttling immigration. And the way they're doing it is, oh, you're ready for an interview? That's nice. Wait in line.
The Islamabad embassy has some of the longest wait times, in part because they have taken on many Afghan cases after the U.S. embassy closed in Afghanistan. That's on top of the worldwide interview backlog of 400,000 cases.
Unfortunately, it seems to be relatively widespread that it's taking several months to get an interview.
Patrick Pettibon is a Houston area immigration lawyer who is not involved in this lawsuit. But he says his firm has also considered legal action to hurry up interviews.
Part of it can be attributed to the pandemic and backlogs that resulted from most of the embassies and consulates being shut down.
But Pettibon says since the embassies have reopened, some backlogs are continuing to grow.
It does appear to be at least partially due to how they're deciding to allocate resources.
In other words, the U.S. is fast-tracking some interviews, like with tourists and students, while letting people immigrating to the U.S. wait in line. In College Station, after Salman and Hawk say goodbye on their daily video call, Hawk looks defeated. It's been an emotional week.
My dad had a stroke Sunday morning. And I think that really was hard. Very difficult, I think. I cried a lot. But it's hard.
He's been facing his dad's critical illness without his wife or any other family nearby.
So, yeah, that's it. I've been in the hospital for the past 2 days. And I have friends who visited. But there's no family. Family is actually the one who's most invested in this. So,
but amid the despair, a glimmer of hope. His wife finally got word that her consular interview is scheduled for March.
I don't know what to feel at this point, but just one day at a time. That's how it is.
The couple is a step closer to being reunited as a family in Texas. Thousands more remain in limbo. For The World, I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
In Brazil, awareness is growing of a humanitarian crisis on the country's northern border. Indigenous communities there are being ravaged by malnutrition and illness, also illegal mining, in particular wildcat gold mining, which increased 300% under Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro. The new government of President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva is pushing back. Reporter Michael Fox has a story.
Last week, the Lula government kicked off its largest operation to date to stop illegal mining on Yanomami indigenous territory. Videos of the operation have gone viral over social media over the last week. In this one, officers from Brazil's environmental protection agency, IBAMA, approach a boat of illegal miners trying to motor into the area. The officers wear bulletproof vests over tan and camouflage uniforms. Their guns are raised. Stop, they yell. Stop, turn around now. The officers pull alongside the boat. Get your hands on your heads, they yell. You're going to come with us. The miners comply without a word. There are eight of them in the boat, which is packed with bags and supplies. Since the operation kicked off, IBAMA officers have found and destroyed a plane, a helicopter, and other heavy machinery. Removing 20,000 illegal miners is not an easy task. Yanomami territory along Brazil's northern border is remote and huge, roughly two times the size of Switzerland. Last week, a delegation of Yanomami leaders traveled to the U.S. to raise further attention to their cause. They want to steal our land and destroy our nature, our water. Leader Davi Kopanawa told the UN Secretary General at the opening of a Yanomami photography exhibit in New York, "They're bringing disease. That's why we're here." Fiona Watson is the head of the London-based NGO Survival International. She worked with the Yanomami for decades, and she was with the delegation in the United States.
So we had political meetings in Washington with the Organization of American States, with the State Department, USAID, and various Congress people. And I think that was really important because Lula met with Biden on last Friday, and it really, I think, put the Yanomami crisis into the spotlight.
O Fantástico entrou esta semana na terra indígena Yanomami em Roraima, cenário de uma tragédia humanitária.
The news reports and images of starving Yanomami children have shocked the world in recent weeks. 570 Yanomami children are reported to have died from malnutrition and curable diseases under the Bolsonaro government. The communities are battling malaria, mercury poisoning from the wildcat gold mines, hunger, and constant threats from the miners who are backed by criminal groups. President Lula visited the region in mid-January where he promised to turn the tide. I'm here to say that we're going to treat our indigenous peoples as first-class human beings, not like fourth or fifth-class people, he said. Lula has declared a humanitarian crisis for Yanomami territory. In this video, Brazilian soldiers are delivering aid, food, and supplies to Yanomami communities. Yanomami leaders blame former President Bolsonaro for empowering illegal miners, gutting indigenous and environmental protection agencies, and ignoring their pleas for help. Junior Ecurari is the president of the Yanomami Health Council. Many teams came from Bolsonaro's government to see our reality, he told the Brazilian news outlet Brasil de Fato. I took them around and showed them firsthand, but unfortunately, they just turned their backs or closed their ears, he said. Brazil's Supreme Court has called for an investigation into allegations of genocide by the Bolsonaro government against the Yanomami people. But in an interview last week, Bolsonaro's former environment minister, Ricardo Salles, denied any wrongdoing by the former president.
A responsabilidade
sobre aquela situação é conjunta de toda a sociedade brasileira.
Salles blamed all of Brazilian society and applauded Bolsonaro's attempts to legalize wildcat mining on indigenous lands, which he said could have regulated the activity and its impact.
Aí a varação, a galera varando. Aí tem gente pra frente.
Meanwhile, numerous videos shared online last week showed groups of miners voluntarily packing up and leaving their camps in Yanomami territory. Survival International's Fiona Watson says this is positive, but
it's so easy for these illegal miners to go back. And of course, all the politicians and big economic interests behind something like the gold industry are still there.
Yanomami land is only one of numerous indigenous territories that have been invaded by illegal miners in recent years. In other words, indigenous leaders say the government efforts are an important first step, but there is a long way to go. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
What if on this Valentine's Day you could get Edith Piaf to sing a personalized love song for you? Or imagine writing some heartfelt words for your very own sweetheart and have them sung by none other than the late great Ella Fitzgerald. For better or for worse, this is no longer a fantasy. French DJ David Guetta discovered that for himself.
This is the future rave sound. I'm getting lost in an underground. This is the future rave sound. I'm getting lost in an underground.
As he DJed a rave recently for what looked like tens of thousands of fans, Guetta fired off a sample over his mix that sounded a lot like Eminem, except it wasn't Eminem.
There's something that I made as a joke, and it works so good, I could not believe it.
That's David Guetta explaining on his YouTube channel his recent forays into the world of artificial intelligence.
I discovered those websites that are about AI. Basically, you can write lyrics in the style of any artist you like. So I typed, write a verse in the style of Eminem about future rave. And I went to another AI website that can recreate the voice. I put the text in that and I played the record and people went nuts.
Okay, maybe I should take back what I said earlier. Edith Piaf singing a few words written by yours truly. That could be cool, although I don't know if anybody would go nuts exactly. Seeing as it is Valentine's Day, we're going to stretch the limits of music technology.
Quand elle me prend dans ses bras, elle me parle tout bas.
Going back exactly 10 years to when Andrea Bocelli revived the classic love song La Vie en Rose, the big 1947 hit by French chanteuse Edith Piaf. In 2013, though, Piaf had long been gone, but through the magic of studio mixing, she returned in this duet. A little weird. Today, though, we'll take it. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
We were blown away by the support we received during our 2022 fundraiser. Over 668 listeners made donations to support The World. Here are just a few of those supporters. Adam Kapp, Paul Dunlop, Karen Clothier, Eden Furtak Cole, Regina Bernaga, Diddy Hitchens, Stephen Kent, Venicia Kelly, Paul Jackson, Deborah Smart. While we weren't able to individually thank each person who donated, know that here at The World, we are forever grateful for every single person who listens to and supports the show.